So thank you very much for the nice, the two organizers that are still here, for the nice work you have, plenty of work you have done to organize this tremendous workshop. It was really a pleasure to be here. And thank you to the rest to be really until the very end to hear what I'm going to talk today. So it's not bipolar gases. There's going not to be anything about bipolar gases, but I'm going to have a bipolar molecule. And what I'm trying to explain is the effect of having a mixed field orientation to orient them, and how this is not non-adiabatic. So the outline of my talk, it's going to be divided in mainly two parts. After a short introduction, I will present the result for a complicated molecule, the asymmetric top molecules. And then afterwards, I will go to a more simple molecule, which is still three atoms, is oxygen, carbon, and sulfur. It's a linear molecule. I will present the results, and I will finish with some conclusion. I mean, the motivation is, it's going to be very short, because I don't think we really need a lot of motivation here. It's like we need electric field, magnetic field, and like laser field to control, manipulate, to cool all these systems, to trap them. And while we are doing that one, the internal structure is significantly affected of molecules. So what we do is then to study how these external fields affect the internal structure, the rotational motion. And this is of interest because we need to control chemical reaction, molecular collision. We have also the molecular frame investigation. There are many things that for these studies, it's really needed how the rotational structure is affected by the fields. And I'm really going to talk about complicated molecules, this asymmetric top molecule and linear molecules. And we all know that complicated molecules are complicated systems. You have electronic structure, we have vibrational structure, we have many things. But I'm really going to do the simplest as possible, and then I'm going to consider the gas as rigid rotor. And let me start first reminding you what is the difference between alignment and orientation. So when we align the molecules, to do the alignment of the molecules, we normally use AC fields. This is the Hamiltonian of a rigid rotor, where we have the rotational kinetic energy and we have the interaction with the laser field, where I have done already the average of a rapid oscillation. This is where you don't see the interaction with the dipole moment, and this is now supposed to be time independent. So what we have with the alignment, we have the confinement of the molecular fixed axis along the laboratory fixed axis. And this is normally measured with the expectation value of cosine squared. What we form normally when we have the laser, we form pairs of quasi-degenerate states. And in this case, we don't know where it's head or tail of the molecule, so we just have them aligned. So if we have a dipole moment, we cannot say where the dipole moment is pointing. So this is alignment. And orientation, what we add is a well-defined direction. We know where the dipole moment is pointed. And this is measured with the expectation value of cosine theta, which approaches to one, the largest is, the closest to one is the more is oriented the molecule. And in this case, we only need strong DC electric field, a static electric field to orient. And we need that the molecule has a dipole moment. And this is now the Hamiltonian. We have a rotational kinetic energy, and we have the interaction with the dipole moment, which is a static electric field, and this is mu, the dipole moment, and this is cosine theta. Here I didn't say, but this is the the delta polarizability, the difference between the two polarizability, and this is the perpendicular component. So now, in this table, I am presenting some results for OCS, the molecule I'm going to study at the end. And what we say is, like, for example, if we use this is the third, this is field-free case, there is not the, in the ground state, the molecule is not oriented, we have just little bit of 0.3, which is no alignment at all. And then we include an static electric field, and we really need to go, this is to 60 kilovolt per centimeter to have a significant orientation, 0.6, which is not very large. The dipole moment of OCS is 0.7 dB, so it's not too small. So we need really 60 kilovolt per centimeter. And if we do with the alignment, with 10 to the 11 watts per centimeter square, which is a normal number for the experimentalists working in this field, we already get a pretty good alignment with 0.78. So now, a major breakthrough came with a proposal by Bretislav, which is here, Bretislav Friedrich and Dudley Herzberg, where they came to really, they had really a great idea, and they decided, how can we get a strong orientation without needing such a strong electric field? And then they decided, okay, let's add a weak DC field with the non-resonant linearly polarized laser field. The idea is what I wrote here. We form pairs. When we have an alignment, we form pairs of quasi-degenerate states that they have different symmetry. Adding an electric field, what we are doing is breaking the symmetry and coupling them. And that gives rise really a strong orientation having really weak electric field. Now the Hamiltonian include both the interaction with the static field and the interaction with the laser. And this is the last example here, where we are only using 600 volt per centimeter, which is not much. It's really small. And we get really a large orientation, larger than with 60 kilovolt per centimeter. And the alignment is not affected. This is where the wave function is plotted, the ground state wave function as a function of theta. And then you see like the red one is not really oriented. This corresponds to that one. The green one is already oriented. Now the blue one is the one aligned. You have a probability in both close to theta equal to zero and theta equal to pi. And this pink one is the really aligned one. So now the next question was if it was possible to do it this experimentally, if it was straightforward to do it experimentally. And it turned out that it wasn't. And the problem is that this pair of quasi-degenerate state, one gets oriented and the other one gets anti-oriented. So it means that the net orientation you get at the end in your being, in your molecular being, it's very small because you have many states that they are populated. So oriented, anti-oriented, at the end it turns out that you don't have much orientation. And this is plotted here. There are several states with m equal to zero. And here I plot cosine theta as a function of the intensity of the laser with some static electric field. And you see how it's going each one of the rays. So now let's come to the asymmetric top molecules. And I'm going to be brave enough to explain you an experiment. Being a theoretician, the first thing I have to do is to explain you the experiment. It's a beautiful experiment done in there were two groups. Johann Cooper was still in Berlin with Gerhard Meyer and Henrik Stapelfeld. I think the experiment was done actually in Denmark. And the experiment has two parts. The first part is this one I'm going to explain first. This is the experimental setup. And what they have here, they have a bin of molecules. And what they do, the first thing they do, they use a deflector. This is what is presented here. They have a gradient of the electric field in the perpendicular direction. This is the perpendicular direction. And on the horizontal direction, the electric field is very homogeneous. So that makes that in the horizontal direction, the molecules don't feel any force, but in the vertical one, they feel really strong, they feel a force depending on the effective dipole moment. This is the energy as a function of the electric field they are using. So they really they feel a force depending on the rotational state that they are. And in such a way, what they managed was to open the molecular beam. They deflected the molecular beam they were having. So the molecules continue flying here. And at the end, they recorded in a CCD camera. This is benzonitril, the molecules they are using. And this is this kind of shadow. This blue, it used to be blue, now it's like green. So this is the region of the electric field where they are working for around 60 kilovolts per centimeter until 100 something. So they managed to deflect the molecules. And what they did in addition was to compute theoretically where these molecules will end up. So this is the molecular beam they have when the molecules are not deflected. And this is the deflected part. So what you see, it's completely shifted because those having the lowest rotational state, they will be deflected more than the other. And this is what you see here in this red one. And to do this, they used a semi-classical calculation where they included a Monte Carlo distribution of the molecules at the beginning, and then they used like the slope of these curves here. So now they were able, this is the vertical axis here, so they were able to decide where they want to do the second part of the experiment, if they want to do it here or here, and the second part of the experiment is this part where I'm going to explain you. So now when they have deflected the molecule, they have reduced the amount of rotational state that they are using, they align and orient the molecules. And this is down here. They have a JAK laser to align them. And in addition, they include an electric field. The electric field is there, actually. They don't need to include the electric field because it's between the repeller and the extractor that they have here. And the electric field is very weak. It's 300 volts per centimeter. So now they play, now this is linearly polarized. They play with the orientation between the laser and the DC field. When they are perpendicular, they only get alignment. And this is what they were able to measure. And when they are non-perpendicular, they get in additional orientation. So what they do is once they have they align and oriented molecules here, they use a probe pulse. And the probe pulse is a titanium sapphire. These are the data for the experimentalists if they are interested. The probe pulse would make a Coulomb explosion of the molecules. And they collect the ions in this CCD camera. And this is what they are collecting. So for a theoretician, what they are doing is projecting the wave function, the 3D wave function, on a plane. This is what they are doing. So this is in the field-free case, and these two cases is when they are using only alignment. You see that they have the same above and below. And this is when they have some orientation. These are like, I think, 45 degrees and 135 degrees. And you see that you have broken this up and down symmetry, and they really have orientation. So now what they measure in this image, to get the alignment, they measure the expectation value of cosine theta 2D, which is the polar angle in the screen, just on the 2D projection here. And they really got a very nice number, almost 0.9. This is for benzonitril. And for the orientation, they just came to the idea to count pixels. So they count the number of pixels in the upper part compared to the total. And this is for this figure where they have 71% of the molecules that were hitting the upper part of the molecule. So now,
What are these different?
This is like one intensity, 5, 10 to the 11. And this is like 7 or 8, 10 to the 11. And this is the same intensity, but they change the angle between. So this is 45 degrees, but 135. So it's going, as they change, the ion is not going up, but it's going downward.
So it's not possible just to do spectroscopy anywhere?
It's possible to do many things, I think, to measure, but this is the way they decided to measure. They could do also like velocity imaging, but this is the way they measure. And they needed.
The film explosion is not a complicated thing. I mean, the
molecule
looks quite complicated.
The molecule is complicated. It's more complicated.
If it was diatomic, you could imagine.
Sorry?
If it was diatomic, you could imagine, it's easy.
Yeah, this is one of the approximations we are doing, that they have recoil approximation, that it's really going, the ion is really going at the direction it's oriented. This is one of the approximations we are doing.
Which ions is it breaking into?
CN plus. This is for this molecule. Each molecule, they break an ion different. Okay, this is for benzonitrile. So now I was contacted and convinced by Johann Cooper to reproduce this figure. He, one summer in Berlin, he said, you have to do a symmetric top in combined fields. Nobody has done it. And I think it was too complicated for an experimentalist to do the calculation. So he really convinced me, and I convinced my PhD student, and I said to him, we have everything. We know what we have to do. From the experimental point of view, we get the field configuration. We know their intensities, we know the static field, we know everything. So we have the field setup. And now we also get from them the molecule. We got all the rotational constant, the polarizability, and we got the dipole moment, which is large for benzonitril. So this is the ion that they are measuring on the fragment they are measuring on the screen. And then we need to figure out how to compute this cosine squared theta 2d and then up and total. And they also gave the population. So the molecular beam that I got for them was having more than 150 states populated. It was really crazy. From this measure that I did, this theoretical study, we only include 82 of the states, and this supposed 98% of the experimental population of the experimental beam. And we also got from them the velocity distribution. So if we thought how to make a theoretical study, a proper one, a real one, it was too demanding. There was too many things to be included there. So we thought we should believe the experimentalists and do and treat this problem as an adiabatic description. We were always saying this is an adiabatic, so we treat adiabatically. And then we know what to do. We have a plan, a straightforward more or less. We have to solve the time-independent Schrödinger equation, adiabatically follow all the state where we include the intensity, project the wave function. We need to project the wave function from our 3D wave function to the screen, and then use a probe laser, use the effect of the probe laser, and also, well, now include the volume effect and velocity distribution. And once we have this, we can compare summing with overall the populated state to the experimental weight. So it was more or less straightforward, but I think my PhD student never believed me, and he always was asking me, are you sure this is really adiabatic? So this is how my Hamiltonian look like here. This is the field configuration. We have the laser along the z-axis in the laboratory field frame. This is the static field, and this is just the relation between the Euler angles that relate the molecular fixed frame and the laboratory fixed frame. So the Hamiltonian has a field-free term. It's a asymmetric top. That means I cannot solve it even analytically, even in the field-free case. I have the start interaction, which is proportional to cosine theta s, because now cosine theta, the electric field is not any longer in the z-axis. This is one of the problems they have. They need to tilt in order to measure the orientation. And I have the interaction with the laser. And there are many approximations. Here you have some of them. I'm doing Bohr-Oppenheimer approximation. I am assuming that the electronic and the vibrational motion are not affected by the field. I'm not including the intense, the laser is indeed a pulse, and it has some duration. I'm doing the oscillation over the frequencies. The time average over the oscillation. And these are mainly the approximation, and then we have to deal with the symmetries. And they are complicated. I'm not going to go into detail. They are complicated symmetries here. And the field-free case, we have still two good contour numbers, which is the rotational and the projection on the angular on the z-axis of the laboratory fixed frame. K is not any longer a good quantum number for an asymmetric top. Well, but in the presence of the electric field, the symmetries are significantly reduced. And we really need to work the symmetries out, because to compare with the experimentalists, we really need to know which state we were dealing with. So each irreducible representation was treated independently. Otherwise, we could not make an identification with them. So now we project the wave function. That was not too complicated to do. This is the density of the wave function here, of the square of the wave function, the density. We integrate in chi. Chi is the angle where the molecule is rotating around itself, because it doesn't have any. The chi is not important when you project the wave function. So we integrate in chi. We include this. This is the selectivity of the probe. It's taking into account how is the probe laser, is it elliptically or is it linearly polarized? And we include this in addition, which is the velocity distribution. The velocity distribution is given here, the dots at the experimental point, and then we fit it to this double Gaussian, and they told us this was background noise, so we sifted down to the red one. So now we have the projection of the wave function. This will be the probability already in the screen of my wave function. That will be already my wave function projected on the screen. They have this funnel double because they have two channels of the Coulomb explosion. So you could, it's already in the... No, it doesn't get easier. You could see actually in the figures I was saying before, you see there's a little bit that there were two maximum on the top and two maximum on the top. No, it doesn't. They're like two ions. And it was not easy, actually.
So can you say a bit more about that picture at the bottom? I didn't quite understand.
So these are the dots were able to measure the velocity distribution of the ions that they were recording. And since each ion arrived with a different velocity, we made this integral taking into account the velocity of each one in order to be able to reproduce better this 2D screen projection. And what they told us that this part here was noise, so that they were measuring, there were these two. This is why we did this blue fit, and then we sifted to get rid of the background noise. The points are really the experimental weights that they have. And we also, I think I forgot to say.
So it integrates to one?
Sorry?
If you integrate that curve.
We normalize everything to one. Even the projection on the screen, we normalize in such a way that it's normalized to one. And in addition, we also took into account the volume effect, which is not written here. The volume effect is taking into account the fact that the molecular beams have some size, and then the laser has a spatial distribution also. So the molecules in the center, they see a larger intensity than the molecules in the side. And they gave us the how this spatial how the laser look like spatially was also a Gaussian, and we also took this into account. So now this is the 2D, like now this is the we make now the sum over all populated states, and these are the experimental weights they gave us. So we have the probability. With this probability, we compute this cosine square, the expectation value of cosine square theta, and this is m up n total. This counting pixel for us is transformed in making an integral on the screen. And we did it. The first study was to do alignment. Alignment was very well understood, but it was a way for us to check it. This is, for example, this is to see how, for you to illustrate how complicated it looked like the spectrum. This is the orientation, the alignment, sorry, as a function of the intensity. It's only one of the irreducible representation we have. We have many avoided crossings, so we have to take care of all of this. This is the alignment already in the screen for using different, how is it called, a probe laser. And it was very good agreement with the experiment. They have also that for very intense alignment, for very large Jagd pulses, for very large intensities, could not distinguish which probe puzzle they were using. And this is the comparison from experiment and theory. We got 98 and 0.98, and they got 0.89. These are the screen projection that we got. Here you see like the double hump that we have in the velocity distribution. You see like this a little bit too maxima here. And also here you see like this is the due to this velocity distribution. So I was a little bit disappointed because I thought that we will do it better. We could reproduce the result much better, but it turned out it was not all fault. It was benzonitril. It was the problem is the molecules they are using, because with this ion they are projecting, the ion they are detecting, there is another one which is C2N2 having the same mass to charge ratio. And this ion is not good to measure the alignment. And what it's doing is that making the picture dirty, the experimental picture dirty, so they are underestimating the real alignment that they have. So this was, it was good actually. For iodobenzene, for example, we were much better, but we wanted to do benzonitril. Anyway, we came to the orientation part, and the orientation part got a little bit complicated because we were not really able to reproduce anything. They got 0.71 and we got 0.53. So we thought, where is the problem? It's we have a problem in the code, but we didn't find anything, and the problem was that we have really a real and complicated level structure. So for perpendicular fields, when we only have alignment, there are 8 irreducible representations. For non-perpendicular fields, we have only 4 irreducible representations. There are many avoided crossing among this state, and we could not ensure that all of these were adiabatic, that all these crossings, these avoided crossings were crossed adiabatically. So we came to the idea to make a non-adiabatic model where we take into account this adiabaticity criteria, if you want to take into call it. This is mesh. We computed this for each avoided crossing. These are the 2 states avoided, included in avoided crossing, the splitting in energy, compared to the coupling due to the chain of the laser field, which is the time-dependent one. And the criteria, if this is much larger than 1, this is adiabatic. If it's much smaller than 1, this is adiabatic. And what we found out is like when delta m, being m, the magnetic quantum number, the field-free, it's not equal to 0, you have here this eta parameter, this is very large. So these are really crossed diabatically, while when delta m, they have the same magnetic quantum number in the field free, they are crossed adiabatically. The idea here is that the static electric field is breaking this azimuthal symmetry, and this mixing different state with different magnetic quantum number, but the static field is very small, it's only 300 volts per centimeter. So the mixing between a state of different magnetic quantum number is very small, and this is what allows us to say, okay, that this is what we are going to do, the avoided crossing. And this is what they did. There was an idea, so we decided to divide the avoided crossing we found in a way, and then to classify them according if they were diabatic or adiabatic. And we got a much better agreement, actually. So this is the orientation n up compared to n total as a function of the percentage of my beam. What we did was to include a state by a state. So we have this 82 state. We include the first one and then the second one. And this is here's percentage of a state in our beam. Here we include only the first one, the second one, and so on. The red one are the adiabatic results, and the blue one are obtained within this diabatic model. You really see that at the beginning, when you have only few states, this is, they are the same, but in the moment we include two more and more states in the molecular beam, they are really different. And in such a way, with the blue result that they are diabatic, we were able to predict 0.64 compared to the 0.71, which was the comparison was much better. And these are the figures we got. So at least we got a comparison. I was not happy, actually, again, because I wanted to have, like, if they have 71, 72, 69. But it was really, the experimentalists were very happy because it was the first time it was proved that this was not really adiabatic, that you needed a non-adiabatic model to reproduce the orientation that they were getting. So that was the first conclusion. So a non-adiabatic model was needed to reproduce this result. And this was the people that was involved in this work. This is the two PhD students, Omiste and Martin Gardner. We were also collaborating with Peter Smelger, and these are the experimental group. Henrik and Stapelfeld and Jochen Kuppe were the group leader in one in Aarhus, and the other one now is in Hamburg. So there was very nice collaboration, and they contacted again and said, but we have OCS, much simple molecule, and we really make a very nice experiment. It's the same experiment as before, but they were very great with the experiment because they managed now to get only two states populated. 92% of the molecular being is in the ground state, and they are, I mean, this is J and M, and 8% is in 1, 1, and 1, -1, so it's 4% of the worst percent. It's the same, they have the reflector, and then they have the orientation and alignment, so they have exactly the same. And then they said, okay, Rosario, will you not reproduce this result? This is what they have. This is orientation as a function of the laser, and this is also orientation, but now as a function of the angle between both fields, so when they are perpendicular, you don't have any orientation, and then you have this nice figure. What is important here is that they have two static fields, like 300 and almost 600, and they are both fields, both static fields, give you different results. This is the intensity of the pulse, and this is, they have 8 nanosecond pulses. And the theoretical model, the first thing we did was use to the Reed rotor approximation and the adiabatic one. It didn't work out. You can see it here. This is the orientation as a function of beta. You have here all the parameters for this molecule. Both results for both static fields are here. We have this kind of edges, and we were not able to reproduce the smooth orientation as a function of beta, and nor we were able to reproduce this nice behavior as a function of the intensity of the laser. But that was known already. We knew that for an asymmetric top, it didn't work, so it could not work for a diatomic. So we came for a triatomic. We came to the point that there is no way out. We have to solve the time-dependent Schrödinger equation. We have to include that the static field is in the time-dependent. They switch on with a ramp. And the laser, they have a Gaussian pulse. We have to include explicitly how the Gaussian pulse look like. And some details here is we use the split operator method for the time propagation. And for the angular part, we use the discrete variable representation in terms of the spherical harmonics. And then we do the rest is the same. We do the projection of the wave function. Once it's propagated, we project it on the screen. And now we use velocity volume effect, but not velocity distribution, because they didn't measure the velocity distribution of the ions. And we could compare with experiments now. This is the results compared to the experiment. I mean, the solid line are still the adiabatic model. And the dotted line is the time-dependent results, including volume effect. The red one should be compared with the black point. This is the weakest electric field. And for the strong electric field, I have the blue one compared to this pink square. And you really see that it's very nice because we are really able to reproduce this smooth behavior as a function of theta. Not only that one, but both static fields give a different result as it should be. And the same here, orientation as a function of the intensity of the laser. We see that we are reproducing very well here. It's a little bit more problematic over here, but we have this able to distinguish that this intensity is giving a different result. So we reproduce the main data. Here there is a table where you compare that for some of the intensity, like strong intensity, we do it very well, for other no. Well, we try to figure out why we are not doing it so well. One of the things is like, for example, this recoil approximation, we are assuming really that the ion is going in the direction of the dipole moment, which doesn't need to be good. These weights the experimentalists are giving me in OCS, I trust more than in the other case, but they are not completely, I think this have to be reviewed how they compute this weight. And there is another thing that I learned it, that I always say that as a theoretician, I know what is a Gaussian function. I plot it in my computer and I know how to work it. When they say that they're using a Gaussian function as a pulse, it's not a Gaussian function. And it's really affected because it's given the way they fit, it's very important for us, the width of the pulse. The 8 nanosecond make a big difference if I am not using an 8 nanosecond, but a 7 nanosecond. So this is another thing that maybe we should include the real pulse they are using. But it was really good. So now we only need to understand why it's not adiabatic. And the point is in this figure, this is the energy as a function of the intensity, and this is forming these quasi-degenerate pairs that I told you. And the problem is when the electric field is already on in the experiment, so these two states have the same symmetry. And what I am doing is when I increase the laser field here, when we are increasing the laser field, and this is the blow up of here, when we are including the electric field, there is one moment that the energy separation is of the same order of magnitude as the coupling due to the electric field. And what's happening is that we are too fast with the laser field, and it's propagating population between the ground state to the excited state. So I'm not from this state, I'm transferring population from the black state, which is the ground state, to the green one, because now they have the same symmetry, and they are completely coupled by the electric field. This is presented in this figure. What we did now was to compute the, we made an expansion of the wave function of the, for each time step, or not each, but every 100 time step, we make an expansion of the wave function in terms of the adiabatic wave function. So for each time, for this 100 time step, we solve the time independent Schrödinger equation and we project a wave function. These are the coefficients of importance of each. And this is what I am plotting here. This is as a function of intensity, which is as a function of the time of the pulse, when I am switching on the pulse. And this is the true result here, 45 degrees and 89.5. So the 45 degrees, which are the solid line, you see that at the beginning, I am in the ground state, nothing happened. And when I am in this region where the doublet is formed, I transfer population to the other state. And this is why they cannot be adiabatic, because the two states are coupled, and I am transferring population. When it's not the ground state, it's even more complicated because we have a population redistribution at the very beginning, and then it turned out that at the end there are two several states that they are coupled. And the point is that, as I said before, this is oriented and this is anti-oriented. So at the end, the net orientation that they get is much smaller than if we will really keep adiabatic with this one. So the next question is, do they really get orientation? Adiabatic orientation, sorry. This is the adiabatic criteria, the adiabaticity criteria that they gave you before. And there are two options to make this really much smaller than one. So when we increase the static field, we will increase the energy gap between the two states in a doublet. That means one option is increasing the static field. This is here, the orientation as a function of the intensity of the static field. And you see, I mean, it's for several field laser intensity. You really see that when I am really strong, like 700 volts per centimeter, I'm really much closer than adiabaticity. They should collapse somewhere here. So it's really much closer to adiabaticity. So they use stronger static fields in their experiments on the use, or they increase the width of the pulse. Because if they are, instead of using an 8 nanosecond pulse, they are slower with the pulse, they will not be this transfer of population. And this is shown here. This is, again, orientation as a function of the full width, half maximum of my pulse. And you really see how it's really increasing as if I use a 20 nanosecond instead of the 8 nanosecond that they are using. So there is a door open for the possibility of being alignment. And so the conclusion is indeed that what they call adiabatic orientation is indeed non-adiabatic. And we have defined a new adiabaticity criteria based in this splitting of the in the pendular limit, because before they were always saying that we are adiabatic if we compare the rotational constant with the laser. So this cannot be done like that one. For the orientation, you need to compare this energy splitting, the time due to this energy splitting to the pulse, the full width half maximum of the pulse. And we are We gave them explained them how they could be indeed adiabatic. I mean, there are two main, and the work was done with this in collaboration with all these people. Mainly, there are two important guys. The first two are very important, are the PhD student. Jens Nielsen is doing all the experiments for OCS, and Juan Nomista is my PhD student, which is going to finish this year. He made all the time dependent calculation. Then we have Henrik Stapelfeld, Johan Kufer, and Bratislav Friedrich, which is here. And with this, I thank you for your attention.
On this quote, there was a symposium to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Max Planck paper on the bright body radiation in 2000. And Dudley Herta gave a talk on exactly this.
Nature having noted.
Mechanics, pointing out that it's actually in some ways more intuitive than classical mechanics.
When we were discussing the asymmetric top with Johan, and we were not really able to, because in asymmetric top was really like the same edges. It was not included in the paper. I always told him the experiment is not correct, and he always was telling me nature doesn't have corners. That was the only answer. Said Johan, there is something wrong in the experiment, and he always told me this. So this is why I always put it. And indeed, it was the theory, which was not the theory that we were using, was not correct.
Doesn't that somehow say the opposite? Because I mean, what you have is non-adiabatic.
We have non-adiabatic.
Non-adiabatic are the quality effect.
Yeah. But they had the experiment; they were not able to interpret it. So at least we figured out what was going on. But the point was that the description we were doing, we could not make it. So that was the point. And now we are trying to do the same for asymmetric top, because they have the experiment, and then they want that we reproduce the asymmetric top. So everybody's tired for questions, so shall we go directly to questions?
Rosalia, maybe you can elaborate a little bit more on the second result. I think it's for the linear molecule,
where
you did take into account the adiabatic effect, you made time-dependent calculation. So the result theoretical is much closer.
Much closer to the experiment.
Right.
So we.
But the tendency altogether is kind of different, right?
The
goes, right.
No, look, if we look at the red one, which is the red one is the 300 volts per centimeter. This is compared to the black dots, and they also have a maximum here, and it's decreased.
Okay.
We have the maximum. The problem is that the experimentalists insisted, Henrik and Johan insisted, that the way we include the volume effect, we should include a power to the third in the intensity. And this is why we get this large discrepancy here. So if we include only a power to the one, it will be much better. But according to them, they have done another experiment where they were able to record the ion, and they really think that they have this power to the three effect. And what we are seeing here, actually, this maximum is like what this is telling you is like this part still is adiabatic until here. But in that moment, the energy gap is too small. When they large, you have the intensity of the laser. Then the energy gap is too small, and this is why it goes down. So actually, if they will only have these two states in the beam, they will be ideal if they were with these weak intensities around 2. The maximum is around 2. This is why they have this maximum, this discrepancy. And the blue one, I agree, is not that well, but...
If you shift it, just down.
Yeah, I think there is always like... there are many things that we have not included in our theory, because the experiment is not very... Being a theoretician, I imagine it has to be very complicated to record this ion and then to measure the orientation. And we have, for us, there's no loss anywhere, and this is why we have such... We normally hear with this when we have always larger.
But qualitatively, right, the black has some peak, right, at the beginning at 2.5, and you have also around this, the red dot.
This one?
Yeah, red dot curves, the theoretical, right?
Yeah, this one.
It has also peak a little bit below 2.5.
Yeah.
But close to the experimental peak in black, right?
Yeah, this is the peak they have. I didn't realize about the peak. It was the experiment, the Jens Nielsen, the PhD student, who said, yeah, we also have a peak here. So, okay, we also have a peak
there. Well, I also didn't see it.
No, no, I, for me, no, but you see, and it really goes down. This really goes down. And what we did really was to take each state and propagate independently. So we took the ground state and we took the excited state, and then this is the sum of both of them. Okay?
Would there be any way not to have to do the full time dependence?
No, there's no way.
So this is basically.
No, because you need to know what you need to know, Suzanne.
So the point is,
you need to know how much you transfer to the other state.
Yeah, exactly. But
and for that one, for each time we project in the wave, in the time independent wave function.
But the point is, if you have, I might not have the right way in my hand. But the question is whether one can, so to say, the main time dependence. I mean, the point is. What happens is that your time dependence basically acts like an additional coupling. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So whether you have, so to say, one main time dependent term which you really kind of, for example, can parametrically include as a coupling instead. But I really don't know how much this is really if you have
because they
one fairly narrow time dependent of one fairly narrow. Frequency or time step.
So that, like, I mean,
component, whatever.
According to this, like, you have really, it's really well localized where you make the time transfer.
Yeah.
So once you know, actually, we could do the propagation until that point and keep this coefficient because this is now keep constant.
But if you would make a Fourier transform, it looks like you would also have a fairly kind of well-defined Fourier component.
Yeah, but that's for the ground state. It's get more complicated here. Here you have now four states, and then you have to figure out how they were transferred. Here at the beginning we cannot see the way they figured that, but here at the beginning there is already some redistribution in the population, and this is why I get four states here. So, and the higher is this is going to be.
Of course, yeah, right.
Okay.
Right. Any more questions? Okay, thank you so much.